Hello, and welcome to Original Lines, the podcast where we talk to original people with original ideas living the creative life. My name is Laura Allen. I'm your host. And as you may know, April is National Poetry Month. And we have a very special guest for this episode. It's Claudia Castro Luna. Claudia served as Seattle's first civic poet from 2015 to 2017. And she's recently been named as Washington State Poet Laureate for the 2018 to 2020 term. She's the author of two books, Killing Maria's from Two Sylvias and This City from Floating Bridge. Her work's also appeared in numerous journals and anthologies. She writes poetry and nonfiction, I understand. Her other projects include the wildly popular Seattle Poetic Grid, which I hope to talk to her about, which is an interactive poetry map of Seattle's many neighborhoods. Hello and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, yeah. We're really, really glad to have you. Congratulations, by the way, on the Poet Laureate.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah. How did that feel when you heard that?
Oh, I couldn't believe it. It's such a tremendous honor and such a, it's such a huge realization, really, that it was hard to take in. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was elated.
Well, that was, that's March, April. That was only been a couple months ago, right? Like November, December when it was announced.
So. Yes, it was announced. Yes, exactly. at the end of last year, and then the passing of the laurels ceremony took place January 31st, where Todd Marshall ended his term and handed the term over to me.
Awesome. Well, yeah. What's involved in being the Poet Laureate? Do you kind of set your own agenda, or are there things that you...
Yeah, you set your own agenda. I mean, you serve at the behest of the governor. Mm-hmm. So if he were to have some project or something that he wanted to have the laureate do a poem for, you know, a public works project, and Todd did do that, then we would write a poem and present it. Uh-huh. But the agenda really is set by each individual. There's a lot of requests from across the state to do readings and teach workshops, and that fills up a lot of the schedule. But then each person is asked to present some ideas and some projects that they would like to see happen in the course of their tenure. And so that's part of it too. So alongside the requests and public appearances across the state, everybody has their own little agenda of things they want to see happen.
Right. Right. Well, do you have any big plans for...
Well, I do.
I kind of thought you might. I've seen your note.
Yeah. So one of the big plans is to extend the idea of the poetic grid for Seattle and do something like it for the entire state.
Oh, wow.
It would look different than the grid because the Seattle map is a street grid because it's a city. It's a pretty small compared to the state. It's a pretty small territory. Mm-hmm. So the state map will be an interactive map, an interactive poetry map. The scale won't be to such small degree because it would be hard to navigate.
Right.
But that's the idea. I'm hoping that it will take a while to pull it off. Mm-hmm. The grid was, I released it at the end of my term as civic poet because it took many months to make it happen.
Right.
So I'm hoping that this project will be announced at the beginning of my second term and that somewhere in the middle I'll be able to release this map that will hopefully live on so that it could be used in classrooms. That's my hope, I guess, that it could be because it crosses so many territories, poetry and geography and history. I'm hoping that teachers across the state will use it as a tool, as a learning tool.
Interesting. For our listeners who aren't familiar with the Seattle Poetic Grid, could you tell us a little bit about it? And how did you have the idea?
I'll start with the idea because the idea really, I thought of the idea as I was contemplating applying for the position of civic poet for the city of Seattle. And I was thinking the selection process happened for the civic poet is that you submit a portfolio, it's a large-ish portfolio that included also a project that you might like to do. Mm-hmm. And so I thought a lot about what project that might be. And in that thinking and mulling over, I thought the idea came to me. It was very clear from the beginning. It just was this thing that landed in my head. And I thought, how great would it be to have a map of Seattle and superimposed on it a series of poems that work like a grid. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we have an electrical grid, we have a sewage grid, we have a street grid. Why not a poetic grid? So a series of poems that connect the city in some way. And so I proposed that. That was, from the beginning, one of the proposals I made to the city. Mm-hmm. And I must say, I did ended up being selected as the person, not necessarily because of the project. I think the project was very abstract at the beginning, and it took a while to for me to sell it to people, for people to come along with me and say, okay, let's explore this idea. What would it look like? Mm-hmm. Because in the end, it looks almost exactly as I imagine it. Uh-huh. I had a failed attempt to do it. I found through the city, through the Office of Arts and Culture, who support the Office of the Civic Poet,
right.
I found a platform that I thought would work, uh-huh. That would show the geography as well as the poems, but that fell through. It couldn't handle text. It could handle images, but the text wasn't so efficient.
Right.
And so that fell through. And we had put, I put work into it, and then that didn't fly. But then the magazine Arcade, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with it, but it's an architectural magazine here, published here in Seattle, did a special issue on immigration. And the person who curated the magazine approached me and said, would you write an article on the immigration, on the architecture of immigration here in Seattle? Mm-hmm. And being an immigrant myself, I thought, yes, I'd love to do that. I could talk about, you know, the Salvadoran experience or Central Americans in the Puget Sound. But I met with him because I wanted more clarity as to what he was thinking for this article. And in that conversation, I told him that I wanted to do this map. And he was the first person who understood clearly what I meant. It was a very strong connection and mm-hmm. a very strong alignment. And he said, he's a cartographer. He's almost an architect at this point. He's a student at the UW, a graduate student. And he said, if you ever need help with a map, I could help you. And at the time I said, you know, thank you so much. I actually have a platform and we are working with it. And lo and behold, a couple months later, that fell through.
Right.
So I looked back to him and I said, you know, that didn't work. Would you be willing to sit down with me? And it was an incredible collaboration that resulted in the map, because the map is both very technical and it's also a book in a way. I mean, they required a lot of the poems on this grid, which is a map of Seattle with blue dots on it, superimposed on the map. And you click on each of these dots and a window opens up with a photograph and a poem about that specific place where the dot is located. And so I did a whole bunch of writing workshops across the city trying to get people to write poems of place with the idea that eventually they would go on the map. And they did. So that's what the grid is about. I invite you to look at it online, because it's hard to explain just with words.
It's very interesting. It's very beautiful. It's a fully interactive experience it very much captures a lot of important things about Seattle, I think. Its diversity, it's really its love of the arts. I mean, Seattle really does love its arts.
Yes, it does. Yeah. And somebody thanked me at the end. I did a reading at Open Books, mm-hmm. the poetry only bookstore. And I invited many of the, because the poems, there's, I believe now, almost 82 poems, I think, at this point. And every single one is written by a different person. Some of them was huge. I mean, published books, others who had never written a book in their lives before.
Right.
And so when I did this reading, I invited, as many as who was willing to come. It was an open call to do this reading. So I think we had maybe 15 people come and read. Some had never read publicly. So it was really a touching, you mm-hmm. know, experience. And somebody in the audience said, thank you for doing this for Seattle. And I thought, it was really nice that this person said this, because in fact, this was for me a gift to the city. It was mm-hmm. a way for all of us who live here to, you know, to see ourselves in a different light, mm-hmm. to see ourselves maybe in a kinder, though not all the poems are kind, but maybe to experience ourselves through these words that come from, you know, deep within ourselves. They're not just any words. These are words people took time to write these poems, and they're trying to express something particular mm-hmm. about their feelings with regards to the city. So I really appreciated that because it was a loving gesture on the part of the people who wrote poems, uh-huh. and the project itself was done in that kind of spirit.
Mm-hmm. I'm from West Seattle, and I go like to the Poetry Bridge and also the Words West series.
Yes.
It's always talked about. It's talked about.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah,
that's
everybody. Good. The poets love it, and the public loves it. I mean, there's certain things that only poets love. They're like, oh, this is wonderful, but it's only poets that talk about it.
Yeah.
But this seemed like a project that everyone got behind. This is your neighborhood. It's like this pride, and this is our West Seattle poet. What's his name?
Kung Woon.
Yes. And because he works with Poetry Bridge, with Leopoldo and with Poetry Bridge. And anyway, expanding that to the state, that should be really interesting. That would be a big project. Are you still going to go around and try to do the workshops in the various areas of the state?
I think what I'm going to do with this project is I'm still trying to pull it together in my head. My original thought for this was that this project would be accompanied by a series of lesson plans mm-hmm. so that teachers really, I mean, the lesson plans would be general enough that a grammar school teacher as well as a college professor could use the prompts to guide students through their, to write poems of place. And again, uh-huh. they go back to poems of place because I have such interest in that.
Right.
But because it's so specific, it also tells us something about ourselves by talking about our environment. Mm-hmm. And I will travel the state mm-hmm. and hopefully I'll do some workshops. I can't get myself everywhere. So this is why I'm thinking that doing lesson plans and encouraging others to produce poems that then would cycle back to me would be a way to get material for the map.
Well, your first degree is in urban planning, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So that seems like it kind of plants. I mean, that seems kind of a natural overlap. You thinking of things in like systems of communities and this sort of thing, and then the poetry. Was poetry always your first? Did you always write, or was it something you came back to? Or
yeah, it was. Well, I think I've always written. It took me a long time to see myself as a writer. Mm-hmm. And actually, when I was going to graduate school for urban planning, I really considered doing an MFA. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to do an MFA, but I didn't have any means of financial support for myself. And I thought going into becoming and giving, turning myself over to writing to that degree at that time, just didn't seem to, it. I couldn't visualize living off of my writing. Mm-hmm. And not that I'm doing it now. I mean, I'm living off of it emotionally, but I couldn't really count on writing right. to provide a living for me.
Right.
And I, you know, it was one of those situations where I didn't have anybody to encourage me to say, yes, you can. You could do this. You could do journalism. You could write grants for a nonprofit, whatever. All these things that I learned, I discovered later that writers do.
Right.
I didn't know. And because I've always been interested in issues of social justice and organizing and communities and how, depending on where we are on that spectrum, either enhances or limits our life and how to change those dynamics. The urban planning program at UCLA offered a lot to me in that sense. And mm-hmm. I thought, you know, this is the other thing I think about all the time. And so I could see myself working as a planner.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up going into this very multidisciplinary program at UCLA, and where I ended up writing. I always wrote. Writing always came around. I always ended up doing writing-related projects,
right.
you know? But when I left grad school, I went and I worked for a union, for a local. The UFCW ran the biggest local in LA at the time, and I ended up writing for them. Mm-hmm. So even though I was doing this work in this political milieu, I was really writing, you know, and I started a publication within that. It was like more than 200,000 members. A lot of them in the meat packers division were monolingual Spanish speakers or had very little knowledge of English. So I started a publication geared to them in Spanish. So, you know, again, I found the route that took me to writing.
Right.
eventually, many years later, I was already married and had kids. I realized this was not going to go away. I needed to take this seriously. And so I did. I went and did an MFA and have been writing ever since.
Well, good. Well, we're glad that you have. It's funny though, how that always plays in. You think you go off this one way and then you come back and then it all kind of comes together. And,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. Well, pretty soon we're going to need to take a break, but I would love to have you read some of your work for us. Would you?
Sure. Mind? Yeah. I could read. Well, before we turn on the microphones, mm-hmm. I was letting you know that I just did some translation, my own translation of some of the poems in my last book, Killing Marias, mm-hmm. which is a book that took a long time to write, really, but I'm learning all books do in the end. And this started, I started writing this when I was an MFA student at Mills College, thinking about women's bodies and how women's bodies are represented. How do we as writers represent them? How would I represent them? And really make a conscious effort to think about that. Because a lot of times we say or do things without, you know, the consciousness that we really need. Right. We just say things in passing. So in thinking about that, somehow, and I really, it's one of those things, I don't know how this happened, that a voice or something told me to turn to this femicide in Juarez. Mm. And so I started looking at that. I knew about the femicide. I didn't know as much as I do now. I didn't know the extent to which women were terrorized in Juarez. And I didn't know the number of women that have been killed, which was, by the time I was looking at it, already in the hundreds. Mm. And all of the women really killed because they were women, hence femicide. I mean, they hadn't done anything wrong. They didn't owe money. They were not adulterers. They were not, you know, they were not stealing. They had done nothing other than be female. And this is why they were, most of them, abducted and then assassinated in really horrific ways. And most of them were abandoned in ditches or on the side of the road. So it was very hard reading the material.
Yeah.
But I decided to write it both as a way of not forgetting them, as a way of keeping them present and their sacrifice and their lives, you know?
Right.
Even if it's just in a poem, which offers no solace, really, I don't think, to the families and their loved ones. But it was an effort at that. And also an effort at thinking about domestic violence, which is what surfaced for me in the course of writing the book, that these women, many of them, most of them were murdered because they were hunted down. It was very eerie. A lot of them looked almost identical. Mm. I mean, they were after a type of person. But there were many women who were older, mm-hmm. who had children, and many who were very young. I mean, 12, 10. Mm. And so it was clear that domestic violence, in some of these cases, in my imagination, but I dare to think that it is how it happened, incidents of domestic violence resulted in death for the woman. But there was no judiciary way of persecuting the husbands and bringing them to justice. So then all these murders went unpunished. And many who had nothing to do with this other femicide just got blended into this huge, you know, horrible scenario for women in Juarez. So then I began to think about domestic violence in my life and in our lives, and thinking that I often thought of domestic violence as having to do with couples, having to do with lovers. And I started thinking that that's not the case, that children are abused. And I don't mean sexually, I mean verbally abused, that mm-hmm. they are also hit. And that then brought a certain consciousness to myself and my own experience growing up, because I thought, as I wrote the book, and this went through many versions, that at one point I was not in the book. Mm-hmm. And I thought it's really important to put myself in the book, because I wanted the book to really consider this idea of violence against women and girls. Right. And so some of the poems, there's 2-3 poems maybe that relate to my own experience growing up as a Once I realized that I too had been violated, not sexually, but punished with physically punished
right.
when I was growing up, and that that is a form of violence that doesn't go away ever.
Right.
And so that's another one of the considerations in the book. So I'll read two poems.
Okay.
And I'll dare read my translations.
Okay.
My own translations. Okay. So I'll read two poems. I want to say one more thing about these poems, and that is that I kept, so the book is, contains 45 poems. Mm-hmm. 43 of them are written to specific women. And because the book, when I started looking at the names, these hundreds of names, it became obvious to me, or it jumped at me, that many of these women had the name Maria in their name, as part of their name.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very common in Latin America. I mean, people sometimes have three names just so that Maria could be one of them, mm-hmm. you know. And I myself have Maria as my name, as my second name. I never use it, but it's part of my name. But many of these women's, their first name was Maria.
Mm-hmm.
So as I was researching and thinking about this issue of representation, I started thinking about the Catholic prayer litanies of Our Virgin Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a very beautiful prayer that it essentially contains a series of names to describe Virgin Mary. And I include the litany in the back of the book because if you've never read it, I thought it would be worth it. It's kind of it's a very poetic prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So she's described as Mother most amiable, Mother of our Creator, Virgin most faithful, Gate of Heaven, Morning Star, Health of the Sick. So these very beautiful images.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought then of conjuring flesh and spirit, and that I kept the woman's original name. And then instead of using their last name, I used a line from that prayer. And sometimes I took the liberty of using a poetic line of my own instead of a line from the prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So when you hear the name, it's actually the name of a person. So I'll read the English first, and then I'll read the Spanish, since they were conceived in English first.
Okay.
So this poem is titled María de Jesús, Mother of Weeping Rocks. It starts early, before you learn to speak, even before you leave the hospital in your mother's arms, that your body is not your own, that women's paychecks are cut short, that women's wombs remain law-controlled. You'd think after all these years, things would be different. The pink that casts your gender, a diaphanous cage, passing as rosy charm. A fine chainmail to be worn at all times. And now the Spanish. María de Jesús, Madre de Piedras Llorantes. Empieza temprano, antes de aprender a hablar, aún más antes, antes de que sales del hospital en los brazos de tu madre, que tu cuerpo no te pertenece, que el pago de la mujer vale la mitad, que los vientres son controlados por el Estado. Creerías que después de tantos años las cosas fueran diferentes. El rosa que moldea tu género, una jaula diáfana, armadura metálica, cota de malla, ligera tal vez, pero aún, pretendiendo ser amuleto, rosa lleno de promesas. And then I will read this other very short poem, María Eugenia Harvest Tower. María, you rose on a shallow grave. The desert refused to swallow your dew. María Eugenia Torre de la Ciega. María, tu rosa tirada en una fosa. El desierto se rehusó a tragarse tu rocío. María Isabel Cup of Morning Sun. How many among us bear marks, blue-green like gasoline rainbows under long-sleeved shirts? How many among us bear marks, abuse watermarks in the lining of a lukewarm smile? How many among us swing between courage and defeat in the span of a day, in the span of an hour, in the swing of a second? María Isabel Taza de Sol. ¿Cuántas de entre nosotras portamos marcas azuladas, azuladas como arcoíris de gasolina bajo mangas largas? ¿Cuántas de nosotras llevamos filigranas, estampas de abuso en el forro de sonrisas tibias? ¿Cuántas entre nosotras se mecen entre valor y derrota en el trámite de un día, en el lapso de una hora, en lo que se mece un segundo?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know that you can find Original Lines on both iTunes and Stitcher? So whether you have an iPhone or Android, you can always catch the latest episode. Be sure to subscribe to us, and we love reviews. Thanks.
Okay, and now we're back with Claudia Castro-Luna. Before the break, you read some of your poetry to us. It was beautiful. Thank you. The translation. Was English your first language? Did you...
No, English was not my first language. I learned when I was 14. My family came from El Salvador. Mm-hmm. We arrived in Miami. And 2 days later, I was enrolled in a school, in a high school, where, you know, this was a comprehensive school. So there must have been 1,500 kids, over 1,000 children. I mean, it was a big school. Uh-huh. And I didn't speak any English.
Wow.
And there were no, I mean, this is 1981. There wasn't really the bilingual programs and the support for English language learner students. So there wasn't really any support built in for me. I was given a schedule and I learned to navigate as all freshman students do. But this was in the middle of the year because it was January to go from class to class.
Wow.
The brilliant move on the part of the administration was that they put me in a Spanish class. It was a Spanish 2 class. And I thought that was kind of silly. But in the end, the teacher was amazing, a Cuban-American woman who essentially understood. I mean, that was my anchoring point of the day because I could go and I could speak with her.
Right.
So it was like I looked forward to being in at school. In the middle of the day, I knew I could talk and I would be understood. But she made me a tutor in the classroom.
Oh.
And so, and of course, we were all sophomores. So I would see the same kids in the biology class. I would see the same kids in the PE class. I had the same lunchtime as a, so I was constantly seeing these kids. And by her making me a tutor, which meant I graded their papers, I made suggestions in the writing because she forced everybody in the class to speak Spanish. Suddenly I was the expert and they were, you know, not.
Right.
And so they could see that I was not, I don't know what the kind word there would be, but that I could think.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that most people make the mistake of thinking that because you don't speak English, you cannot think. And that is really hard for right. the person who knows that they can't communicate.
Right.
And, you know. And so that was my chance to show that I was actually, you know, very capable. And the teacher also ensured that all the grammar that the kids were learning in Spanish, she was teaching me one-on-one in English.
Oh.
So she also taught me grammar.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, it was wonderful because it gave me some sort of footing
right.
in the school. But that's how I have always been a very dedicated student.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied myself. You know, I walked around then with a dictionary, and so I would find words and point to the word that I wanted to
right.
to say. And the other thing that happened was I was placed in a choir. The school had a very successful music program and I never sung in a choir. But what it did was it also allowed me to sort of be in this art, you know, in this space where language wasn't there. I could feel the impact of the language through the music.
Uh-huh.
And we weren't really speaking or answering. We were just singing these songs. So it also, this was another class where I felt that I could be part of the, you know, just blend in with the 50 kids that walked into the choir and just kind of sing along. And the teacher didn't speak any Spanish, but she was kind, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time, this was January, by the time fall came, I was speaking, I was able to sort of get my, I learned to move around the school.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's how I learned. When I graduated high school, and, you know, a little aside there, we moved to Florida I repeated the 10th grade by choice because I felt that I had only done half a year of the 10th grade. So I asked my parents to let me repeat and do the full, you know, from fall to spring. So we were in New Jersey. I repeated 10th grade. And then we were in California, a very typical life of an immigrant family, sort of following relatives to where there was work and, you know, better weather and just more support. So we ended up in California where I did 11th and 12th grade. And by the time I graduated from high school, the school gave awards, you know, of course, the big valedictorian and salutatorian, but also in each department, there was a senior that got chosen for excellence and, you know, and dedication, I guess. And we were all assembled. The whole school was assembled in the gym, and the senior class was in the middle of the gym, and they call these awards, and their names go in this little plaque at the entrance of the school, and they called the English award, and they called my name.
Wow.
And I could not believe that they had called my name because, you know, 3 years before I couldn't speak a word of English.
Right.
And here they were awarding this, giving me this award, which I think came from sort of my dedication to writing, really, because I was always, you know, I was involved with the school newspaper. I was involved with a literary magazine at the school, and I was still an English language learner. I was 3 years in. Normally, they say it takes 7 years to really understand and be fluent in the language. So I was still, you know, at the beginning of it. But I think it was sort of this desire that I had that was recognized by the teachers. And to this day remains the most, I'm most proud of that award. You know?
Well, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Well, that would probably, the urge to communicate, but I mean, being put in that situation and you're as a freshman and sophomore and not being able to really communicate with like you want to, that would make a lifelong impression.
Yeah. It was really frustrating. It was really frustrating.
Yeah.
I remember a conversation with a student in the cafeteria with switching back my dictionary back and forth. And this is how I learned the word sophomore, because this girl was saying to me, it took me a while to figure out, At least you're not a freshman. Yeah, you're having all these difficulties, but at least you're not a freshman.
Right.
And I couldn't understand. You know, she kept on saying, "You're a sophomore. You're not a freshman. That's the lowest of the totem pole. At least you're not a freshman." And so I eventually understood. This is how I know the word sophomore. The word sophomore is attached to that experience in that cafeteria where this girl was trying to show the other side of the coin for me. You know.
Nope. No way. That's wonderful. Let me ask you about your writing specifically. Do you have a schedule that you follow? Do you have a certain time that you write? How does that go
I mean, for before you? Occupying the position of civic poet, I was writing in the mornings because I have three kids and they go to school, and it's the only quiet time that I would have. So I would try to capitalize in the early morning. The civic poet, those 2 years changed that because I also used that time to do things, to teach workshops, because that's when my kids are in school. So the morning is the best time for me. I'm free to do things, run errands or write. But the writing time became less and less. It became more difficult. And now it's very hard to write because I've been teaching a class at Seattle U in the morning, and I just have a lot, you know, meetings and things like this happen during that time because I cannot make them happen in the afternoon. And so what falls off is the writing practice.
Yeah. It's going to be a challenge.
That will be a challenge. Although I'm forcing myself, I'm really trying hard to write even for a little bit early in the morning before the day begins. Just not to lose the practice is really important. And I'm preparing myself for traveling quite a bit.
Right.
So in April, I will be spending a week in Walla Walla, so that eastern part of the state. And then the following week, I will be in the San Juan Islands. So I'll go from the, you know, easternmost little corner of the state to the westernmost, you know, tip of the state. And that will mean being away, not being home, you know, routine will be, you know,
right.
I will not have a regular routine. So I'm trying to get up and do some writing.
Yeah. Is it important for you, for your writing, to have the regular routine? I mean, some people, it seems like people fall on one side of the spectrum or the other. The routine helps, or getting out of the routine helps.
Yeah. No, for me, it's more the routine. Mm-hmm. Although I have to say, I've read, I also always have paper, and you know, I always have a way to capture what it is that comes to mind.
Right.
I used to carry around a little recorder, which now I don't need because phones have that capability. So I'll record myself if a thought comes in, or a line or something, or I'll take a photograph, or I have lots of notebooks in my bag. And so I also write as I think of something.
Right.
And I've learned to force myself to do that, because if I don't, I'll be home later on in the day and I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot remember what it is I so clearly thought, you know,
yeah.
And told myself, you'll never forget it. And then I come home from my walk and I have forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
So I've learned to be appreciative and let go of, you know, sometimes I'll compose something in my head and I'll think, I'll never forget it. This is so clear.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll come back and I will have forgotten. And I have felt terrible and really bad and just really annoyed with myself. But I've learned not to do that. I've learned just to say, okay, that was it. It just existed for that little bit. It was an ephemeral poem.
Mm-hmm.
And it hopefully will come back. But
yeah.
Not to feel so guilty, not to give out to myself so much.
Yeah. What about your children? Do any of them, what do they think about the mom, the poet?
Did they
get into it?
Yeah, I think that they're very proud. I think that they find it amusing.
Mm-hmm.
And that I'm always saying things like lines of poetry at home, and they've gotten used to that. But my oldest daughter, who's 16, is a really great writer.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't write poetry, she writes prose, but she's really gifted.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very happy for her. I hope that she continues with that. And that gives meaning to her, you know, that it gives her pleasure. I mean, it seems that she derives a lot of pleasure from her writing.
Uh-huh.
My son last year, my son is the youngest one. So last year during April, poetry month in school, they wrote a series of poems and he got really carried away with the idea and wrote a little packet of poems, and he was so happy with himself. And I thought, I wonder if he would have done that if he did not have somebody at home whose job is to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they know I write poems. I give them poems as gifts. And so they know that this is something that happens, that people do. And they feel comfortable with the idea of writing poems, which I believe we all could do. So I'm very happy for them that they have an ease about writing. And they know that it's not something that has to be researched. It's something that we feel and that we could express, because we all have feelings. That's what I say in workshops. We all have feelings. We all do, about everything.
Mm-hmm.
We like things, we don't like things, we're annoyed, we object. And because we have feelings, we could write poems, because that's what poems are. They're a way of conveying feelings.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. The support, having the support for that self-expression is so important. I mean, so many people don't really have that much of that. I don't know if it's just because of the children are discouraged, but I think it's just people in general. We're encouraged to share kind of superficial things, you know, but if it gets any deeper, sometimes it seems to make some people uncomfortable, and then you're discouraged from doing that. But I think the poetry, that's the place where we are encouraged to share the deeper, more, you know, those deeper selves, like you were talking about earlier, that the connection with the grid is the connection of the deeper self of.
Yes. Yes, and I'm finding that out with the students that I've been teaching. I'm not teaching a poetry class, but of course I'm teaching literature through the lens of poetry, because it's what I'm most familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And I have encouraged students to write poems. And I have consciously skewed away from giving them too much instruction. I'm somebody who thrives with not a lot of instruction. Mm-hmm. So I always like loose parameters. But then I think, this is what I do. I'm familiar with it. I sort of want the liberty to go where I need to go because I have been there enough times in this territory of writing that I know eventually I'll arrive somewhere. Well, right. That will be of meaning to me. But people who don't have that experience, is really scary to go to that, to open that door, you know, and a lot of folks need guidelines because that's what we think poetry is. Poetry is, you know, rhyme and it needs to look like this and it needs to, you know, we read these wonderful sonnets and maybe they have to look like a sonnet or they have to, you know, have so many syllables. And I always, not that I don't adore Shakespeare and his sonnets or formal verse, but I think if the point is to right, then that is really not the way to go about it. So with my students, I have been very encouraging and given them hardly any guidance and said to them, you know, poetry is very open. It doesn't look one way or the other. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have any boundaries. And that, I think, is how I have come to poetry, because it always welcomed me. It welcomes me every time when I show up at the page. It doesn't tell me write this way or a stanza here or there. It never requires that of me. And so I have invited the students to do the same, and I've been surprised where they've gone with their poems. I think they themselves have been surprised by where it took them. And I would say, some of them would have never thought about the things they're really writing unless they had not written these poems. And after writing several poems, more or less within the same theme, I think they have an understanding about themselves. You know, these are freshman students. I think they've discovered something about themselves that hopefully makes them feel more grounded in this. You know, they're the freshmen again. So, so maybe that's given them a little footing, you know. I hope so. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll kind of start to wrap this up for now. Where can we find out more about you?
That's a good question. Yeah. Well, there's a website I keep for myself, Claudia Castro Luna. But I also am very active on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And that's @Claudia_C_L. And I'm on Facebook. And Humanities Washington, so the position of Poet Laureate is sponsored by two statewide organizations, Humanities Washington and Arts Washington. And Humanities Washington keeps a very almost day-to-day record of the Poet Laureate's activity. So yesterday they published a blog entry. There's a blog at the Washington State Poet Laureate website that I'm contributing to. And they post my activities around the state. So that's a very good resource if you want to know of upcoming readings or, you know, where I will be. And I will be posting, and I'll start through Washington State Poet Laureate, I'll start keeping an Instagram feed too, which will be new for me. But that's another way of keeping in touch.
Okay, great. Well, I know we'll also, I've also heard through the grapevine, we'll see you at Poets on the Coast. This, you'll be doing
a workshop
with Susan and Kelly.
Yeah.
And,
I'm excited about that because it very much will feed into this work with the Marias.
Yeah. Well, that's an awesome, I went last year and, it's a wonderful retreat.
So. Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. It's a beautiful spot.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We're very honored to have you. And this has been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. And this has been Laura Allen for Original Lines. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or any of your favorite podcast services, or visit our website at www.twoponiespress.com. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.